Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Politics Ohio and Poor Will's Almanac. We'll hear about a new treatment for depression, and another report will tell us how farming, food processing, and manufacturing have put Ohio at the center of a food boom. And we've got news about the Springfield Museum of Art coming your way. Up first, this week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, we've told you about an initiative started by the Southwestern Ohio Council on Higher Education, the 20 by 20 Challenge. It's an emerging program to increase the amount of internships in the Southwestern Ohio region. We told you about the kickoff event that took place this past Wednesday at 5th Third Field in Dayton. More than 300 students and 40 organizations took part. I spoke with Sean Creighton, Executive Director at SOCHI. He talked about the ideas behind the program.
We've done some research and discovered that we have approximately 8,000 internships annually between the colleges and universities that are part of SOCHI and the business community. And we developed this strategy along with our partners, our key partners, the Dayton Development Coalition and the Dayton Chamber and UpDayton, to challenge the business community to dramatically increase that number, to more than double the number of internships in our region. And that's where we come up with the 20 by 20 challenge. We're the lead in terms of organizing this effort. We've known from the very beginning that it takes a coalition of activity around internships to reach a goal like 20,000 by 2020. That means working even more closely with the colleges and universities who are already placing their students, expanding our own program. We're launching SOCHI Intern, which is an expansion of our internship program. We're also working with the business community. That's why the Dayton Chamber is a partner and other chambers around the region. That's why the Dayton Development Coalition, whose service area is the same as ours, they're a key partner in helping us achieve this challenge. And also UpDayton, the Young Professionals Group, because, again, this is sort of a challenge to retain our students and engage them in a way that we create not only career opportunities, but opportunities for them to become a part of the community.
Let me just back up a second, and you mentioned a study done on internships and how that affects the retention rates for companies. And what is it about an internship that does that?
There are multiple things. One, there's the relationship that is developed between the student and the company. Then there's the opportunity to see how that student fits in the culture of that company. And then vice versa, for the company to gain a better understanding of that student, their skill set, their knowledge, and maybe areas that they can help that student enrich their learning. And at the same time, we find that students bring fresh perspectives to their internships, and often a company benefits from that as well.
So the 20 by 20 challenge is obviously not something that is a one-shot deal. It's a continuing program. What other efforts are going on?
The 20 by 20 challenge and internship fair kickoff is exactly that. It's the kickoff of the program. We will continue to bring together some of the key partners that provide internships and work with the universities as well to begin to expand opportunities there. We are investigating some deeper partnerships and some funding opportunities as well to assure that we can help assist companies who do not have programs in launching them. There's DaytonInterns.net, and they have some great how-to guides for those companies that do not currently have programs. And SOCHI also puts on internship boot camps to help educate people on internships and bring in sort of companies that have best practices that we see in the region. And we're continuing to explore all opportunities as we move forward in reaching our goal.
Sean Creighton, Executive Director of SOCHI. Sean, thanks for speaking with us today.
Hey, thanks so much, Jerry.
You can follow the 20 by 20 challenge through their website, SOCHI.org. The Springfield Museum of Art has been selected as the only Smithsonian affiliate art museum in the state of Ohio. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that the museum's status will allow it to borrow works of art from Washington, D.C. He spoke with Springfield Art Museum Executive Director Ann Fortescue about the announcement and what it means for the museum's patrons, and first tells us about Springfield's participation in the Smithsonian affiliate program.
Our desire to do that really stems from the outstanding collection of American art that we have here at the Springfield Museum of Art, featuring works from the colonial era through to the present, and the opportunity to really raise the awareness of the collection to people both inside and outside our area. And by joining forces with a museum organization internationally recognized for museum excellence, will greatly enhance and increase those opportunities. There's also much more that will flow our way as a result of the partnership.
In terms of specific exhibits or collections, what might we see appear at the Springfield Museum because of this collaboration with the Smithsonian?
Specific loans, we haven't determined those yet. We certainly will be working with the Smithsonian on bringing educational programs here to the Springfield Museum of Art and tapping into the excellence in terms of the cutting-edge and innovative art museum education programs that Smithsonian staff have been developing.
Will we see opportunities for students in the area?
We will. One of the other benefits of becoming an affiliate is that it provides us with the ability to offer or recommend, you know, college and university level interns, both undergraduate and graduate students, to the Smithsonian internship program. And the way it works is the intern spends a period of time at the Smithsonian and then would spend a period of time at the Museum of Art. And the order, you know, it's based on the project that we'd be working on. So I'm sure that's going to be very exciting and perhaps maybe even a little coveted among the institutions of higher ed in our region, because it's an incredible opportunity.
Well, we know that the Springfield Museum has really exhibited a strong, you know, regional focus on collections of American art. Mm-hmm. How did this prominently help in the decision-making process for you to become a Smithsonian affiliate?
Well, it is an avenue for us to showcase our permanent collections with those collections of the Smithsonian that have national stature, and bring some really well-deserved recognition to the works that we hold here.
I wanted to ask, too, the Springfield Museum of Art, you guys have really done a great job of putting together fantastic exhibits. Do you feel that the community is aware of some of the work you've been doing? How can there be more of an outreach to get people to come to the Springfield Museum of Art?
Well, we are, in addition to our new wonderful partnership with the Smithsonian, we are also working collaboratively with organizations in our own community. We have a partnership with Clark State Community College and Wittenberg University to offer art classes through Clark State's Continuing Ed Department, but here at the museum location. And we make those classes, they're community art classes, and our members receive a 15% discount on tuition for those classes. That's a significant discount. And what it enables us to do is to continue the longstanding tradition of community art classes and having those accessible here in this location, so that the students and the instructors can make use of the museum's exhibitions and collections.
Well, do you feel that there's a possibility that this collaboration may be up and running before the end of summer?
I will say right now we're mounting a major retrospective exhibition of Jack Earle's work to open at the end of September of this year. The Smithsonian has a number of Jack Earle's works, and we've requested to borrow those for this exhibit. So we're eagerly awaiting the reply. As with any large museum, it takes a little bit longer than it does with a smaller size museum. So, but we know that we're in the, you know, we're in the list of being considered, and certainly our affiliate status now gives us a huge advantage in terms of being considered.
Well, Anna, I would like to thank you for your time and congratulate the Springfield Museum of Art with becoming a Smithsonian affiliate. Certainly, I'm sure the area will be very happy, and certainly the patrons there will enjoy that.
Well, thank you, and we're honored as well as delighted to bring the Smithsonian to our neighborhood. So we hope that folks throughout Miami Valley and throughout Ohio will come and enjoy our Springfield Museum of Art collections, but also those amazing treasures that we bring to the Midwest from the mall in Washington, D.C.
That's great. Well, thank you very much for your time, and we appreciate you sharing that information with our listeners.
Thanks again. Have a good day.
You can keep an eye out for Smithsonian treasures and other art online at springfieldart.museum. This is WISO Weekend. Nearly 1 in 10 Americans suffer from depression, but some cases are more severe and traditional treatments don't work. Ann Glauser's report from Ohio Public Radio tells us about an experimental therapy for major depression called deep brain stimulation.
Let's see if I can do something a little more challenging. Maybe not.
I'm at the Cleveland Rock Gym with Ed Agarwala. He's scaling a makeshift boulder with an impressive overhang. It's kind of a metaphor for what he's been struggling with nearly all his life. Agarwala's got major depression. In high school, he had to talk himself through mental exercises just to get up in the morning.
It would be, you know, like I just didn't feel I could get out of bed. And so I had to start with something as simple as, you know, I don't have to get out of bed, just if I can move my hands and feet a little bit. You know, that's just the first step.
Some days he didn't make it out of bed. His depression got so bad in college that he finally sought treatment.
My girlfriend at the time saw how bad I was. I talked to her about that I might actually commit suicide and that it wouldn't be her fault, and she convinced me to please go see somebody.
This was the start of a long and largely fruitless search.
I have tried every class of medication to no effect.
We're talking SSRIs like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, drugs like Wellbutrin, the generic Doxepin, or Marplan, or Cymbalta. He tried intensive psychotherapy, fish oils, even another class of drugs known as stimulants. He also tried a procedure called electroshock therapy, or ECT, where doctors create mini seizures in the brain. This can be an effective, if extreme, treatment for depression. But it didn't really help Agarwala. His depression was pushing him to a breaking point. Then one day, he read about a procedure called deep brain stimulation in the New York Times. It's an experimental therapy for people with severe depression, for people who've tried most everything else. So Agarwala enrolled in a trial at the Cleveland Clinic. And now?
I am a cyborg.
He's mainly joking, but he does have implants in his brain. This is what deep brain stimulation is all about.
I have batteries in my chest and wires in my brain that affect my mental and emotional function.
The battery packs are about the size of cell phones, one embedded on each side of his chest. Deep brain stimulation is already FDA approved for treating things like Parkinson's and tremor. It's being studied for other diseases like severe depression, bipolar, Tourette's. Agarwala describes the moment after several hours of brain surgery to attach the electrodes when doctors flip the switch.
You feel the current run for the first time, and it's exquisite. I mean, the sadness just disappears.
Agarwala's doctor at the clinic, psychiatrist Donald Malone, takes a more cautious tone.
There is no magic bullet. Now, for given individuals, could this be a magic bullet? Yes. Yeah, it could be.
Malone says the therapy looks promising in some cases. He and others have found modest to dramatic improvements in patients.
You know, the reality is that depression is horrible, and depression of this severity is really horrible. It's every day, and it's awful, and people just want out.
Dr. Peter Kramer, a professor of psychiatry at Brown University, says deep brain stimulation is a tool in progress for severe depression.
I think this is interesting, but I really think anyone who approaches it should know that it's experimental and that it's, you know, not first or second rank. It's sort of a last resort.
That's because it is brain surgery, and other depression treatments are much more tested and have more data to back up their use. The hard evidence for deep brain stimulation has yet to come in, but researchers hope to have some reliable data soon. Dr. Malone from the clinic is part of a multi-site randomized control trial, and he says they may release results sometime this year. Medications and psychotherapy remain the most effective treatment options for most cases of depression.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Ann Glosser.
And this month, NPR has been airing a series on parts of the economy that are looking up. Last week, the spotlight fell on agriculture. American farmers earned more income last year than ever. And as WCPN's Brian Bull reports, Ohio is among the states at the center of the food boom that incorporates not just farming, but food processing and manufacturing.
Think manufacturing in Ohio, and you're apt to picture cars rolling off of assembly lines, or maybe glowing molten steel being poured into ingots at local mills. But chew on this. Ohio has another manufacturing sector that's more resilient and generates more dollars. Food. Combined, Ohio's agricultural manufacturing, food processing, and production generate nearly $108 billion a year and employ 70,000 workers. It's the state's biggest industry, and it's growing.
These are some sliced shallots. The starting point of the sauce, I'm going to caramelize them in just a little bit of oil in a hot pan here.
Mark Martin is a chef of Nestle USA. The company's product development center is here in Solon, Ohio, and Martin's hard at work in a test kitchen.
Once these are brown, then I'll add the celery and the carrots, and then I'll just continue to cook them until they soften.
Morton's experimenting with entrees that may soon end up in your grocer's freezer, under the Stouffer's or Lean Cuisine label. Nestle spokeswoman, Roz O'Hearn.
And Stouffer's and Lean Cuisine both are considered billionaire brands. So in the Nestle lingo, that means a brand that has achieved $1 billion of annual sales. There are not that many billionaire brands, and we're just really thrilled that they're right here on campus with us.
Nestle's is just one of the food giants in Ohio. Others with facilities in the state include Dannon Yogurt, Campbell's, Heinz, and Bob Evans. Ohio has food in abundance, raw and processed.
Food production is the number one business in Ohio.
That's agriculture professor Bob Cohen at Kent State. He's talking about how Ohio ranks third in the nation in fresh and processed tomatoes, second in egg production, and first in Swiss cheese. Too bad, Wisconsin.
We see from Lake Erie down to the Ohio River very diverse resources that enables everything from wine, grapes, and fruits in the north to tobacco in the south and beans and wheat in the west and a lot of vegetables in between.
And while other industries have taken hits during the latest recession, food has remained steady or grown. Smucker's, which is headquartered in Orville, is expanding. That's welcome news to Oroville's 8,500 residents. Mike Hedberg is the city's head of economic development.
They currently have over 1,500 employed here in Oroville. They just completed their largest office building to date. They completed an expansion of their research and development building, and they're about midway through construction of a 300,000-square-foot state-of-the-art manufacturing facility.
There's a ripple effect to food production that goes beyond farming and making jam. Richard Linton has identified more than 1,700 food or food-related manufacturers in Ohio. Linton chairs Ohio State's Department of Food Science and Technology.
Paperboard containers, plastic containers, metal containers, glass containers, these would all be examples of common food packaging materials that are used in the food industry.
Some companies, like bio-based manufacturer NewTech Green, are selling retail and industrial projects that use soy and corn-based products made in the state. They're turning soy into ink toner and creating bio-based paints. Sherrod Brown, Ohio's first U.S. senator on the Agriculture Committee in 40 years, says this is another sign of the state's food prowess.
There are, in Ohio right now, 130 biotech, biomed, bio-based manufacturing companies. They will take soybeans or take other crops and turn them into paints and thinners and other kinds of products. And we know there's potential for huge job growth at this intersection, if you will, of agriculture and manufacturing in the form of bio-based products.
With growth, competition is getting keener in some parts of the industry in Ohio, and some say that's making it harder for the little guy. Jay Cult is the executive vice president of Chefco, a Cleveland company that trucks processed meat across the region. He's taken more than a dozen local businesses off his client list over the past few years.
There was a manufacturer in Warren that couldn't compete with Nestle's in producing pocket sandwiches, a couple of hot dog companies here in town. Those businesses were run out of business based on buying power and pricing by the big boys.
Suggesting that as important as the food industry is to Ohio, it's not without its own food chain, where the lake trout still feast on the minnows. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking with Tom Stewart about fracking, a controversial drilling method for extracting oil and natural gas. Last week, I spoke with Jack Shaner, a lobbyist and deputy director of the Ohio Environmental Council. Tom is executive vice president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. He argues that the new technology called fracking will allow Ohio to tap important natural resources while at the same time creating tens of thousands of new jobs in the state. Thanks for talking with me, Tom.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Let's start by explaining fracking. Ohio is sitting on massive deposits of Utica and Marcellus shale, and hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, is a relatively new process whereby millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals are shot a mile or more into the ground to shatter the shale. What are critics of fracking getting wrong?
First off, they're getting it wrong that it's new. We've been hydraulically fracturing oil and gas wells in the state of Ohio since 1952. And since that time, over 80,000 oil and gas wells have been hydraulically fractured.
But explain what's different. My understanding is there's hydraulic fracturing and then there's horizontal hydraulic fracturing and that's what's new. Am I misunderstanding this?
Yeah, I think most people are misunderstanding that. The shale is just one more horizon, one more reservoir where this technology is being applied. We've been hydraulically fracturing the Upper Devonian Ohio Shale now since the early 1960s. That at the very bottom of the Devonian is the Marcellus Formation, but the whole shale column above the Clinton Sandstone has been commonly well stimulated for decades and decades. There's really no magic about it. You're not shattering the formation or shooting or exploding or doing any of these things that are common misnomers in the media these days.
What can Ohio learn from other states' experiences?
It is true that when the Marcellus started getting up on its feet 5 years ago, that some of the people that came in to do that activity did not well understand particularly the shallow geology of Pennsylvania and may not have constructed their casing and cementing programs in such a way as to protect the entire geologic column from infiltration of natural gas, or they might have exposed naturally producing natural gas that they didn't have cased off. Those situations have been corrected.
Energy companies have hundreds of people combing property records to determine who owns millions of acres where they'd like to drill. Are too many people signing leases and giving up their mineral rights too quickly and with too little information?
I don't know why we would say too many people are making money. When a landowner or a mineral owner signs an oil and gas lease, they are not giving up their mineral rights. What they are doing is that they are saying, we neither have the expertise nor the capital to actually access our mineral rights. And so we will allow a company that has capital and expertise to do that for us.
Now, my understanding is that Attorney General Mike DeWine has some concerns both about regulation of fracking as well as consumer protections. Can you tell me what he wants to do that your industry thinks is unnecessary?
Well, when we met with the Attorney General's staff, what we learned is that they were totally ignorant of the current status of the law in which the law states full frack disclosure that goes above and beyond the most famous model known as frack focus being applied in other states. They were shocked to learn that. What we also learned is that the Attorney General appears to be relying upon a document that purports to say how industry would so-called bamboozle people into signing leases that has proven to be a fake. The Attorney General needs to quit relying on fakes and try to understand what the current status of the law is before he goes commenting on it.
The governor wants to increase taxes on your industry and then use that new money to fund an across-the-board 5% income tax. Do you think he's being unfair? Is he targeting you?
He's looking at one industry, an industry in its infancy when it comes to the development of the resource shale play. Without the research and development that's going to take a couple years to figure it out, he's saying this one industry, no other industry, should pony up what his budget director testified to is $500 million.
I've been talking to Tom Stewart, the Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Thanks so much for your time, Tom.
My pleasure.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Wells Almanac for the first week of middle spring. The blooming of bright yellow forsythia bushes always announces the arrival of middle spring. This is the time that the remaining daffodils and grape hyacinths flower, and that wildflower season unfolds in the woods with the blossoming of early violet cress, twinleaf, periwinkle, spring beauty, hepatica, and small-flowered bittercress. Early meadow rue and may apples are pushing up out of the ground. Cowslip is budding in the swamp, and leaves grow long on the skunk cabbage. Japanese knotweed, columbine, phlox, and lupin emerge in the garden. When you see forsythia shrubs in bloom, then the first buckeye, apple, and peach trees are leafing out. At dusk, the first frogs and toads are singing. Killdeer become common along the roads, and woodcocks call near sunset with a nasal-sounding peent. Barn swallows arrive at the barns, and the first baby barred owl hatches. When forsythia blooms, then farmers are seeding the first of the oats and field corn. In town, the lawn is almost long enough to cut, and then nettles, chicory, and leafcup are 6 to 8 inches tall. Asiatic lilies and columbine 3 to 5 inches. Ragwort and garlic mustard are forming clumps. Some sweet rockets and money plants are getting ready to send out their flower stalks. Hops vines twine around the honeysuckle. Japanese knotweed catches up with the rhubarb, which is just about big enough for pie. Water rushes and purple loosestrife, water lilies and pickerel plants have suddenly produced foliage in the ponds and streams where small diving water beetles hunt for food. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of middle spring. In the meantime, find the yellow flowering forsythia blooming in the city or the country, telling you the time of year.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
You've been listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Documentary Hour.
Tonight, we'll hear from food writer Michael Pollan and journalist John Hockenberry. Person, Place, Thing is an interview show where guests don't talk about themselves. They talk about another person and a place and a thing that they feel strongly about. Award-winning journalist and Dayton native John Hockenberry talks about George Seldes and the conceptual shift from reporter to journalist. Hockenberry's place is Bucharest, Romania. We'll also hear from best-selling author Michael Pollan. His person is Henry David Thoreau. Pollan says his life's work has been an argument with Thoreau. That's coming up on Person, Place, Thing, hosted by Randy Cohen, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Up next on Member Supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.
On This American Roots, we follow two giants of jazz, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane, from humble North Carolina beginnings to trials and triumphs in New York City, including conversations with McCoy Tyner, Randy Weston, Pharoah Sanders, and the next generation, T.S. Monk and Ravi Coltrane. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
This afternoon at 2 on 91.3 WYSO.